Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2005, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is an actress. She has a no-nonsense approach to her profession, the reason why, perhaps, she's encompassed so many roles so successfully. Most recently, she won a BAFTA and an Oscar nomination for her performance in Mike Leigh's film Vera Drake, playing the eponymous heroine, the caring Cockney mother, who's also a backstreet abortionist. On stage, she's been nominated for a mass of Olivier Awards, from Guys and Dolls to Uncle Vanya, and she's won two for roles in An Eightbourne and a Sondheim. So she's nothing if not versatile. Born in North London of Irish parents, she enjoyed a happy Irish childhood, which included playing the spoons, went to RADA and did her turn as a stalwart of provincial rep before her career took her to the West End and continued success. She works hard and thinks carefully about the parts she plays, but she says, "I can't be doing with people wittering on about their acting. In some respects, there's not a lot to it." She is Imelda Staunton. I'm sure I'm misrepresenting you, Imelda, in quoting just that, but there is an element of that, isn't there? You know, actors can witter on. It's not what you do.
No. I try to keep it to myself and just do all my sort of wittering or whatever that is, just sort of talking about, you know, just keep that to myself and do it at home. I think there seems as if there's a lot to it if you talk it up. Mm. You know, if you're going to build a wall, you have to know how to get the cement and do it. You know, you have to know how, well, in one way, technically how to do it. But any, I think, emotional input, the things that you have as an actor, that's up to you. No director can give you that.
Mm.
But at the same time, I do just like to quite quietly think about it and do it.
Of course, and you have to dig deep for those kinds of roles. I mean, I mentioned Vera Drake, and obviously she went deep, and I want to talk to you about all of that in a moment. Very complex character, really. And one remembers your Sonia in Uncle Vanya back in 1988. I mean, these sorts of characters, you've got to go away privately and work on them, haven't you?
Mm. Or just empathise, or just, you know, I think I do empathise with those people who maybe have sadness in their life, or are just those hard-working people. You know, Sonia's a hard worker, Vera's a hard worker. Those people who just get on with their life and actually don't really moan about it.
Mm.
Maybe recognise that there are maybe better things, but not a lot can be done about it.
It's like the downtrodden wife you played in the Eightbourne play, which you won, I think, Best Supporting Actress. Well, that was your first, Olivier, wasn't it?
Mm, mm.
Let me mention another one, Peter's Friends.
Mm.
You were the one person who had grief. You were the young mother who'd suffered a cot death, weren't you?
Mm.
Again, a memorable performance.
Mm.
You do seem to have this direct access to a bit of pain. Mm. Where does that come from?
Bloody hell, I don't know. I don't know, really. Is it the Irish? I don't know.
Is it?
I suppose I just empathise with that, and I can feel it, and hopefully sorrow without sentiment. That's what I strive for.
That's exactly what you got in Vera, and I want to talk to you about it, but let's pause for your first record. Tell me about that one.
Now, not a lot of people would, I suppose, if you hear your husband introduced you to Lonnie Donegan, do you marry that man? I don't know. I did. Well, my husband talked to me about how he loved Lonnie Donegan. I thought, oh, for God's sake. But, of course, then I started listening to his music, and a while ago when I did the revival of Guys and Dolls and I finished doing that, I thought, well, I'll never sing again, and I'd love to sing, and I got a cabaret together. And Jim said, well, you've got to listen to old Lonnie, you know, and see what he can give you. And his version of Frankie and Johnny I nicked, and I did that in my cabaret, and I just love it. And I love a song with a story. I do love a story, and this is a great story. G-C-D-O.
And
Johnny Donegan and Frankie and Johnny, recorded in 1956. I can't imagine what your version is like, but we won't have it now in Melbourne. Tell me about Vera Drake instead. Oscar nominated last autumn, Best Actress at the Venice Film Festival, the BAFTA and so on. The job of your life, why?
I mean, I've always liked doing new plays. I've never been one for, do you want to play Hermia in The Dream? I love new writing. Of course, this is the ultimate in new writing because you and Mike are writing it.
Mike Lee, that is. Yes. And it's famously, that this is how he does it. Yes. He develops the character. So you research the character. How did you research Vera Drake?
Well, you don't. You create her. And literally, we create her and invented her from the day she was born. Now, the research is to do with the 30s and 40s and 50s and the war and all the all the things about the time. But for me, it felt like he had a canvas. And in some way, I think he knew the picture he wanted to make. Mm. And then we are the colour and the shape, and he sort of puts us on to that canvas.
So it was set in 1950s London. She's a cleaner, a middle-aged mum, a wife, a caring daughter looking after her ailing mother and so on. But she has this secret occupation, doesn't she? Helping girls out, as she puts it, which is, of course, aborting their babies with a douche and carbolic soap. And she's got her little black bag in the top of the wardrobe, hasn't she? Mm. Did the rest of the cast, your family, know that that's... They just knew they were cast in 1950s London.
Well, yeah, that's everyone, we just thought... I was in... Part of my rehearsals were going off and improvising with the women that I had to deal with. But Mike creates a situation. We rehearse in a disused hospital where people are rehearsing one end and no one meets, I had no idea there were any actors playing police. I had no idea there were ever going to be any police.
You didn't know the police were coming, because that's, of course, what happens at the end. Yes. The police come for Vera Drake, and she's sitting down to a...
beautiful, lovely family tea. And
celebrating the daughter's engagement.
And the announcement of... a baby in the family.
Indeed, there's the irony. And the knock comes on the door. So you didn't know?
No.
You didn't know in rehearsal
on
the take?
When we rehearsed it, which we didn't know was going to be the last day of rehearsal 6 months in, we were rehearsing. We'd been doing this lovely family scene for about 3 hours or so. And, lovely. And I heard a knock and on the door. Now, 99% of my head is Vera. There's 1% of Melda thinking... well, who's that? We don't know anyone else. It's only the family. And when Phil Davis, playing Stan, came in and said, it's the police, he was white. And I got a pain in my chest. And I thought, honest to God, I thought I was going to have some sort of heart attack. I've never had such a pain.
Because you knew they'd come for you?
Yeah. I was so frightened. I was so genuinely frightened. Mm. And as we all were. And it was extraordinary, and we carried on for another 4 hours. I was taken away, I was interrogated. That's when the actors playing my family found out what she did. That, it was the most exhilarating experience, I think, of all our working lives.
Because it was real feeling.
Totally.
Because you'd got yourself so deep into this character.
Yes.
But it's so ephemeral. It's extraordinary. But why didn't you rehearse on film, as it were?
No, well, because then, you then film that 6-7 weeks later. It's all there. No one wrote anything down. I remembered every single word I said, as we all did.
And you remembered the feeling.
You just reinvestigate it. So for Mike to set this up for us to investigate is just extraordinary.
Yes. Sweet, sweet woman. You could have invested her with far too... I mean, it would have been easy to play her with a kind of, too much sentimentality, cheap pathos. Mm. How do you draw the line? Where do you...
Well, Mike draws the line. But, I'm not that sort of actor. I wouldn't go down that road, willingly or unknowingly. But if there was ever a moment like that, Mike would adjust it.
So you live with her for what, 6 months, a year? How long's the
nearly
whole process?
A year, really.
So
it's
what happens when she's gone?
Yes. I felt that was a job well done, and we finished it, and it's time we finished. We've been doing it long and hard, and I knew the experience I had had was the most fulfilling of my working life. And I thought, well, I've had it. I've got that.
Next piece of music.
Now, this is Elvis. Heaven. As a kid, really, this was the first music I heard. I mean, there was Irish music in our house, but Elvis, did it for me. And still does, actually.
My tongue gets tired when I try to speak. My insides shake like a leaf on a tree.
There's only one cure for this body of mine. That's to have that girl and a love so fine. She touched my hand and what a chill I got. Her lips are like a volcano that's hot. I'm proud to say that she's my buttercup. I'm in love. I'm all shook up.
All shook up with Elvis, taking you back to Archway, North London, Imelda Staunton, in the late 50s. Well, when was that recorded? 1957, where you lived with your mum and dad. She was a hairdresser and you lived above the shop, yes?
That's right, yeah.
What did your dad do?
He was a building contractor, you know, worked on the roads, driving machines.
And you were an only child?
Yeah.
And you said that this... Well, I don't think it was a completely solitary childhood, but somehow in that made you an actress, you said. Why? Mm. What do you mean?
Well, I was on my own a fair amount. I think in the evenings, you know, I'd come home through the shop, you know, and that was great, and, you know, that was lovely and busy. But then, I'd go upstairs and, you know, you're on your own. And I think, you know, I maybe created, you know, a world for myself. And I think that may have something to do with it. I mean, I wasn't up there miserable on my own, but I think it's interesting. I have an only child now, but we have lots of friends in the street with the kids, and I find that a great comfort, because actually I do think it's important for kids to have other kids around them.
So what did you watch as a child, or what did
Lucille
you like?
Ball.
Oh, yes.
Well, it's all those American shows, weren't
it? I Love Lucy.
I Love Lucy.
Yes.
Anything with Bette Davis. Yeah. Because I remember thinking, because, you know, all those film stars were so glamorous and gorgeous. And, well, she was a bit off-looking, wasn't she? It wasn't the most...
Yes.
And I used to think, God, you know, I thought her acting was so wonderful. And I thought, and she's not beautiful, and yet she's, you know, she's a wonderful actress.
And that voice.
Oh, yes. Yes, I loved the black and white films. Absolutely adored them.
And you went to school locally, to a local convent school, not the kind of sinister cliche of a convent school. Very happy convent.
Not at all, absolutely.
And did the nuns, therefore, discover your acting talent?
No, they didn't. But, you know, again, with a lot of people, if you're lucky, you have an inspirational teacher. And I had Jacqueline Stoker, who at the time was our elocution teacher.
She was a lay teacher then?
Yes. But she also did drama after school, and she said, I think you should come along. I think you should do some of this. So I used to do drama festivals that kids did, and you do a monologue or a duologue. And then she said, I think you must audition for drama school. Oh, righto.
And she knew, you say, that you should go to drama school. Mm. Did she talk to your parents about it?
Well, I think she convinced them, yes. You know, they'd seen me do school plays and they'd seen the festivals and they knew I could sort of, you know, and I enjoyed it and I could do it. And
yes, but I mean, Imelda, our Imelda being good on the stage at school is one thing. It becoming your profession is quite another, isn't it? That, I mean, they wouldn't have known any.
Not at all. I mean maybe they thought, I mean, as probably I did, that you go to drama school, but then you have to go and get a job. I mean, I didn't know that I'm going to drama school and I'm going to be an actress. You know, at the time, I thought, well, I'll go to drama school, but, you know, obviously that won't work out. So I'll have to go and do something else.
Tell me about the next record, number three.
Well, Messiah, Handel's Messiah, heavenly. But I used to love doing... I was in the school choir and I loved singing in the school choir, mainly because we joined the boys' school across the road. They were also in the choir. But we did the Messiah and I remember every note.
A Child is Born from Handel's Messiah, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra and Chorus, conducted by Sir Adrian Bolt. So having decided, Imelda Staunton, to study acting, it nearly didn't happen, did it? You kept getting turned down, I gather.
Yes, I auditioned for three drama schools, Central, Guildhall and RADA, and I got my replies, you know, from Central, no thank you, Guildhall, no thank you. I thought, well, well, that's it, and I'm not going to get into the other one. And it was interesting because I remember...
You'd never even heard of the other one at first, I gather,
no,
Wada.
No, no, I hadn't. Don't hold that against me, Sue. But I remember the auditions for Guildhall and Central were, you know, just in a room with people behind a desk. And you went into Rada and you went onto a stage and they were in the dark and you were lit. And I thought, oh, this is what's right. I don't want to be in a room. I want to be on the stage. And I remember so loving it and thinking, oh, this is it. I thought, well, I'll never get in. And I remember my mother coming in and she said, there's a letter here from Royal Academy. I said, oh, right. And she said, shall I read it? Yep, if you like, yep. So she opened it. Oh, no, no, dear mother, I'm delighted to say. I said, don't joke about that. Don't do that to me. That's not funny. Because I thought, it can't be. And it was. So that was it.
Amazing.
That was fantastic.
And absolutely the right place for you. Who were your contemporaries then?
Well, I think in that era, I mean, I was there from 74 to 76. And in our sort of era was Alan Rickman and Tim Spall was below me, and Anton Lesser and Juliet Stevenson was below me. So there were, you know, a good few guys and girls there.
And you knew straight away that you were in the right place, did you? It just fitted.
Yes, absolutely. I loved it. And Hugh Crutwell, who was our principal, who was absolutely extraordinary, the passion he had for the job, and that he instilled that in me, and I think in most of us, that it's hard work and you must do it right and you must work hard and then you will reap the rewards, not in successful terms, but just this is the right job for me.
What does working hard mean in terms of being an actor?
Taking it seriously, I think. Taking it seriously, and I do a lot of preparation, although I hope I'm very open. I don't want to wing it, and yet I don't want to be set in my ways, but I want to put the work in and not just think, oh, this is, I can do this standing on my head.
Good number four.
This is a PF, which I was lucky enough to play at Nottingham Playhouse in 1980. It was a, you know, extremely dramatic role to sing and to act, and I think it moved me forward as an actor, and I think that really helped me get my audition for London.
Si un jour la vie t'arrache à moi, si tu meurs, que tu sois loin de moi.
Edith Piaf and Im à l'amour, if you love me, really love me. So, Imelda, 6 years in rep, and you played lots of big parts, Electress and Joan Piaf, as you just said. A lot of responsibility, but without huge exposure. That's great experience, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, that was 6 years of an amazing apprenticeship for me. Because also you'd play all the big parts and then you'd play, you know, the maid in something and, you know, queen something in another play. So it gave you a huge opportunity to just practice your craft. Mm.
But having been up front, you're then sent for by Richard Eyre, who was running the National at the time, and he wants to cast you in Guys and Dolls as a hotbox girl, effectively. One of the chorus, I mean, in the back line. Only five of you, I think, but nevertheless, in the back line. That must be quite... I know you're coming in, as it were, but that must be quite difficult to take.
Yes, well, it was... I was asked to join the company, which was to be in the chorus and then to play as cast in other shows there. And I remember there was one day I was just sort of sitting at the back thinking, what am I doing? What am I doing here? But then, you know, I was sitting watching people like Julia McKenzie, Bob Hoskins, Judy Covington and Ian Charlson, and thinking, oh, that's what I'm doing here. And I think, you know, I recognise, you know, this was a shift in gear and this is what I had to do. I mean, I was understudying Julia, but I mean...
As Miss Adler.
If she had gone off, I would have been on the first plane. I would have been out. I would never have done it. And they could have sued me, they could have sacked me. Can you imagine? Ladies and gentlemen, Julie McKenzie's not here. Oh, no!
The audience. Yeah, no. But this is exactly, as you say, what you were aiming for. And you did, of course, eventually take over, not as an understudy. You took over the role. But I gather that Richard Eyre had to really work on you to persuade you to do it.
Yes. Now,
well, why? Because all we've heard so far is this sort of ambition that you're growing with and is growing with you. Mm. Why suddenly, when it starts to be fulfilled, are you getting coy?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, I don't think I have. I mean, I think my ambition is so quiet. I sometimes could hardly hear it. And I think when Richard asked me to do that, because Julia was so extraordinary in the part, I thought, I cannot follow that. And a bit of me didn't want to follow. I wanted to create something for myself. But interestingly, you know, that was in 83. So I played it in 83 when I was sort of 26. And I did it in the revival in 97. Of course, I was much better. I was the right age. And I tried my best, but I was better this time round, I think.
But it established you, no doubt about it.
Yeah, yeah, it did.
Record number 5.
Well, of course, it's Guys and Dolls, and not only the most glorious show to be in. I mean, even being in the hot box was heaven. But also I met my husband, and, you know, therefore my life was sort of began, really.
Not some fly-by-night Broadway romance.
And you'll know at a glance by the two pair of pants.
I'll know
from the National Theatre's production of Guys and Dolls with Julie Covington as Sarah Brown and Ian Charlson as Skye Masterson. And that, Imelda, is where you met your husband, Jim Carter, who's so brilliant in Brassed Off, among so many other things. The line was that the smallest member of the cast had married the tallest. I mean, what is the difference? It's 5 feet tall plays.
Well, he's 6 foot two. Yes.
But it was love at first sight, was it?
Well, no, it wasn't, actually. We'd worked together for a year and then started realising that actually every time we went into the canteen, going, oh, where's Jim? I want to sit with him. He's funny. He's so funny, so nice. And I think he felt the same. So we thought we should get together.
But we talked earlier about, you know, touching into the darker side of yourself. Did you know it was there before you started to act, or has acting enabled you to uncover it?
I think that's happened. I think it's uncovered it. I do. I mean, I used to think that acting gave me the opportunity to shout, because I don't shout. I don't really have a temper. And so that allowed me to do that, and I think you're right. I think acting has given me the chance to look inside and see what I can offer up.
How big a turning point then was Uncle Vanya, which, as we've said, was in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know you'd got the Olivier for Best Supporting Actress earlier for an Akeborn, the downtrodden wife, who sang. What was the name of the play?
That was Chorus of Disapproval at the National.
But also it was jointly, wasn't it?
Oh, with The Corner's Green that I did with Deborah
So
Carr.
They were serious roles, although in comedies.
Mm-hmm.
But Sonia in I mean, that is really...
She's
so long-suffering. It's such a serious role.
Yes.
Do you think that was a turning point for you?
Yes, I do. And we did that for 6 months in the West End, and it was one of those roles where, you know, I loved every single second and couldn't wait to finish, because it hurt.
Hmm. Which is why you can flick that switch and empathise, as you say, and immediately understand how someone like Piaf or Vera might feel in that moment. I mean, does it go deeper than that? Have you unearthed things? Have you learned? What have you learned about yourself? That you're a pessimist at heart.
Well, I have. I mean, I have got a pessimistic side, but I mean, I also have, you know, I think, you know, a good sense of humour and a sense of irony. And
what about the Catholic guilt? Got any guilt?
Oh God, isn't that boring? Isn't it there for far too long? Far too long. Yeah, of course I've got it. It's getting better.
Working on it.
Yeah, working on it.
Number 6.
Well, of course, part of me wants to be Bette Midler. I don't think it's ever going to happen now. But she's just heaven, and this is just glorious.
He was a famous trumpet man from our Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up, and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blown reveille. He's the boogie-woogie bugle boy of Company B.
and blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he could not jam. The captain seemed to understand, because the next year the cap went out and drafted the band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B.
Bette Midler and Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. You had a difficult time, Imelda, after the birth of your daughter Bessie in 1993, and you've been refreshingly frank about it, which I think helps other people. I mean, put simply, you had postnatal depression, didn't you?
Yes, yes.
What form did it take?
I don't know, just not feeling adequate in any way, and just not knowing how to do it, not knowing how to be a mum, and but physically I'd been unwell as well, so that didn't help. So I got taken back to hospital and, you know, it was just a mess, really. It was a bit of a car accident as opposed to a lovely having a baby, which, of course, is the most wonderful thing in the world. So, yeah, that was pretty hard.
So what happens? You then reject the little thing that made all of this happen or made you feel like
no,
this?
I didn't. No, I actually, it didn't take that form at all. I just rejected myself.
Mm.
No, all positive energy went towards the baby. All actually, and but just on my own, just desperate. And I saw a wonderful gynecologist who said, "You are ill." And I was, you know, I was in a terrible state. And she said, "Just you're ill. Don't we? I'm going to give you some antidepressants." And I said, "Don't give me antidepressants. I'm depressed enough." And
it's also all part of that no nonsense thing, isn't it? It's, oh, come on, you know, I can sort this out myself.
Of course.
Don't need to swallow pills.
Yes, absolutely. And they just allowed me for about 3 months, I think, just to get my nose above water, at the surface of this sort of bewildering darkness. And of course, you know, then you just look over in this corner and there's this gorgeous, happy, loving, kind baby who was just waiting. And I'll always be grateful to her for that, because, you know, that was a huge part of the recovery, that she was so funny.
And how did Jim cope with all of this as well?
Well, he did everything, of course. He had to do everything. He was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. So it was a difficult time for us both. And, but, you know, of course, those sort of things make you stronger. You know, we were older parents as well. You know, we weren't 22 having kids. Well,
what would you? You'd have been.
I was 37.
Yes.
You know, and we had this, you know, this lovely, gorgeous girl, and we thought, right, come on, we can't do better than that.
Next piece of music.
Well, this is my mum playing fiddle with a couple of her friends, and you know, as a kid, we did have parties, and there was, you know, I did hear this sort of music from really when I was a very small child.
And you played spoons.
And God, I'm hot on the spoons. Not very good, but I can do the spoons. So I would do the spoons to this sort of music.
Castaway's mother, Bridie Staunton, playing the fiddle with friends at Alexandra Palace in 2003. Your mum, who died last year, just as you were enjoying all the accolades surrounding Vera Drake and everything, she did make it to one of the big nights.
Yes, she was on my. She was my hot date for the London Film Festival. The film opened that, and so she did the red carpet with me. So that was fantastic, and she had a great night. We both, you know, arrived home at 2 a.m. with our shoes in our hands, having had a great night. So,
And did she live to see you go to the Oscar ceremony and all of that?
No, she. I think she knew about the possibilities. You know, she did know it was a possibility, and that the BAFTA was a possibility. So she was sort of, you know, aware of that. So for me, the last sort of those 6 months really, you know, has had a bittersweet taste, because it's, in one way, all the American stuff was like a bit of a tonic for me. You know, it was lovely to go, and because it was so sudden, her death, and it was so shocking and desperate, really.
Well, you didn't expect it at all?
No, because she went in for a bypass. I mean, she had, you know, heart problems. She was diabetic, but she was only 70, and sitting down. You'd think there was nothing wrong with her because she was so funny and lively. And so it was a shock. Because, you know, bypasses, you go in, you're out on, you know, 3 days later. So it was a huge shock. So yeah, that was November. So then we had, you know, Christmas. And, of course, she'd wrapped all our Christmas presents. Mm. And we had to unwrap those.
Last record.
Well, I just... This is from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? A track from that. The most beautiful voices, and I just love these voices. And what a heavenly sound.
As I went down in the river to pray, studying about that good old way, and who shall wear the starry crown, good Lord, show me the way. Oh, sisters, let's go down, let's go down, come on down. Oh, sisters, let's go down, down in the river to pray.
Alison Krauss and Down to the River to Pray from the soundtrack of the Coen Brothers film Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Now, you've been trying to decide all through this programme which one you're going to take. What is it?
Don't. Well, you see... I mean, originally, and I think I'm going to have to stick with Guys and Dolls because, of course, that means Jim and, of course, Bess. But then I think, well, what about Bette Midler? She'd keep me going. But I think I'm going to have to go for Guys and Dolls.
OK. So I'll know. It'll make you cry, too.
I know, but anyway.
Tears, yeah. Yes. what about your book as well as the Bible and Shakespeare?
Well, I thought, hopefully, there'll be some good stars to look at, and I don't really know much about them. So I think a wonderful book on astronomy so I can find out what... they're saying to me would be rather good. You know, I don't mind being on my own, so I'll be all right, I think. I can't take the sun much, Sue. That's my only problem. So I might have to have a lot of sun cream. I don't know if I'm allowed to take that with me. So, but that would be, yes, I'd be all right, actually.
And your luxury, is it the sun cream or what is it?
Well, I think I might just have to sneak the sun cream in without you knowing, and then my luxury will be some clay... and some tools to do some bit of pottery. Not pottery, what do I mean? It's just
modelling.
Sculpture, modelling, yes. I'd have a go at that. I've done it once. I did a tiny, tiny little head and I just loved it so much. And I've never done it since, of course, but so this would be my opportunity.
Imelda Staunton, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Oh, I feel I've made it now, Sue.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.